tuned to Focus on Campus, a weekly show which highlights faculty, staff, and students here at the University of Texas at El Paso. Good morning. I'm Luis Sainz, your host for Focus on Campus, and joining us today is Dr. Jose Villalobos. Dr. Villalobos is a professor in the Political Science Department, and he's been with us before. We're going to talk a little bit about the State of the Union Address, which happened several weeks ago, but we're going to talk about some other things, including executive privilege, executive order, and just the president and the Constitution itself. Dr. Villalobos, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thanks so much for having me. Appreciate it.
Now, Jose, as we mentioned, the State of the Union Address is something that, you know, every president has given since George Washington, but it's not until, I guess, maybe after Eisenhower or around the Eisenhower that it started getting attention, because it used to be like in the afternoons or whenever, but now it gets primetime coverage. And of course, they get the Republican side or the Democrat side, depending on who's in office. But this particular State of the Union raised some questions. Can you tell us why that happened?
Well, yes, that's a great way to start here. So one of the things, as you mentioned, the State of the Union gets a lot of attention, and it certainly is sort of one of those things that all political observers look to from year to year to get a good sense of a signal of where the president wants to head. We know that from some of our earlier presidents, they weren't as active in trying to legislate, sort of lead the legislative arena. You know, the early presidents are a little bit more careful about, well, I'm over here in the executive. The legislative does what it's supposed to do, and there's a separation. Modern presidents are very active, and you know, they can't directly go in and make legislation, but they move and work to persuade Congress to do things with the public support, because we look at modern presidents and we expect them to have these big programs. I mean, FDR is one of the best examples when he put out his New Deal program. That was sort of modern presidents leading the way. And ever since FDR, presidents want to have a sort of same kind of dynamic with this. So when the president goes and speaks to Congress like this, it's not just sort of the president giving the State of the Union, but it's also the president giving direction. And we have to sort of look at it and ask ourselves, how is the Congress going to respond? What's the relationship going to be like? And as you note, one of the reasons there's some extra attention that has been given this time around is because of the president mentioning some of these executive orders that he wants to do. Over the course of his time in office, I actually remember the last time I was teaching my presidency course, one of the things we talked about in the State of the Union, the president had mentioned at one point, he said, I'm willing to work with Congress on such and such issue, but if Congress doesn't want to act, then I'm going to have to act with some executive order. And there's a lot of reason for presidents to be moving in that direction, given how much more difficult it's been for Congress to get some things done. Presidents make these big promises, and if Congress doesn't do it, a lot of the blame will fall on the president's shoulder. So it's a sort of a paradox they get stuck in, a sort of a dilemma that they're in. This time around, the president, he didn't just sort of say, okay, here's what I want to do and how I want to work with the Congress, and if not, this is what I might go ahead and do some things on my own. He actually has just sort of said, here's some things I'm going to do through the executive branch, and here's some other things I hope to work with the Congress on. I think that's a really big reflection of, I'm not sure if animosity is the best word, but very difficult kind of back and forth between the House Speaker, John Boehner, as a sort of the leader of the Republicans out of the House, and this President Obama. It's not necessarily anything too new, because we saw a similar kind of relationship between Nancy Pelosi when she was Democrat Speaker of the House and George W. Bush was president. So there's this tough relationship when you've got the president and the speaker on opposite sides with this partisan polarized atmosphere. So the question becomes, well, are we sort of seeing a kind of a shift over the last few administrations and moving into the future where sort of a more significant shift where presidents will be sort of it won't be too surprising to see them take more executive actions through the executive branch rather than going through Congress. So for people who aren't so familiar with the difference in those options, of course, when you pass something through Congress, it becomes the law of the land across the board, right? And actually, presidents, that's the best thing they wish and want to do. If they pass a good law, it gets accepted by the other branch of government, it gives a lot of power and legitimacy to that action. And if it's something that they propose and they wanted to see happen, it will bode well for their legacy. But what happens when you have a Congress that isn't getting things done? Just last fall, we saw the approval rating for Congress go as low as 8%. 8%. because of that sort of do-nothing Congress type of reputation. It's tough, and every individual member of Congress works hard to get things done for his or her district. But as a whole, you know, there's a lot of gridlock because there's a lot of divided partisan politics going on. Now, when a president sees that things are not going to get done and wants to try to do things more unilaterally, one of the options they have is going directly through the executive branch, because of course the Congress makes laws, but the executive executes, right? And as commander in chief, or as leader of the free world, one of the big jobs the president has is, you know, being in charge of the executive branch, managing the executive branch, and indeed sort of executing law and policy through the executive. So if the president can't get something done through Congress, or, you know, doesn't want to go through the long process of Congress, he can give what's called an executive order. And that's pretty, if you think about that term, it's pretty much as it sounds. You give an order down to the executive branch so that those the civil servants we have, those hardworking civil servants, right, that day in and day out, they're actually implementing policy. The president signals to them how policy should be implemented. And a great example of that is when we heard about this deferred action that the president took on immigration. The president wanted to pass a Dream Care Act through Congress during the first term. He couldn't quite get it done. But what he did do toward the end of his first term was he said, I'm going to, you know, direct down. It wasn't an official executive order, but it was a memo that went through Napolitano's office, right, as on the part of the administration saying, we're not going to deport young dreamers who want to stay in the country and who are, you know, they're law-abiding and they, you know, they want an opportunity to, you know, seek out their dream and apply and all these kind of things. We're going to defer the threat of them being deported. This was something that the Republicans in Congress didn't want, but he was able to instill that action. And it got a lot of support from proponents of that kind of course of action. So it helped him very much with the election, and we can talk about that in more detail. But that's just one example of what the president sort of can do. Now, what's the downside to that? There's a couple of downsides. Number one, Congress can get upset and say, you know, well, we're supposed to be making policy. What you're doing is kind of bypassing our process over here. You don't have the support of this other institution, right? If a president hypothetically went too far and did too much unilaterally, then you can also have the Supreme Court step in, right? Theoretically, they could come in and say, you know, oh, you know, the Congress is supposed to be doing certain things, or the president is doing it instead. He might be overstepping his bounds. So, you know, they might sort of step in. Now, historically, that hasn't really happened. There's been a few instances, but it's very rare. And so when we think about over time changes, one of the things that happens is you always see there's these separated branches, and they're supposed to share power, and checks and balances go on between them, right? When one branch does something and the other branch can or isn't able to check, that sets a precedent. We've seen it also with war powers. When presidents go and, you know, they say, we got to take some action and we're going to do a peacekeeping military intervention. You know, sometimes Congress gets upset, but presidents have a lot of power in the foreign policy as commander in chief. And the founding fathers may have had, you know, differing ideas on that balance of power. As it stands today, presidents are seeing somewhat of an increase. In the general policy scope of these executive orders, we are also seeing this increase happen. We saw it with Clinton's administration and George W. Bush's administration. They each on their own terms, started using more executive orders and other types of executive memos and directives, what scholars usually just call sort of unilateral executive action. And Obama's kind of picked up with that. And again, one of the big reasons that's happened is because the more polarized politics has become in Washington, the harder it is for Congress to get things done because it's so gridlocked. That reputation of the do-nothing Congress. Presidents with those big expectations on their shoulders, I made all these promises to the American people, I got to follow through on these promises. When they see that they have a dead end in the road down legislation, they say, well, what can I at least do through the executive? And the one other limitation there is that when you pass something into law through the Congress, let's say, you know, Mitt Romney had won the election instead of Obama. He would have come in, and if he wanted to undo Obamacare, Obamacare is the law of the land. So he would have had to, you know, he could have done a few executive things to kind of, you know, limit it. But to really undo it, he'd have to go back to Congress and get Congress to sort of do a reversal for all across the board type of a thing. Now, when you do an executive action, it can be pretty effective. But once another president comes in, they can just reverse that executive action. One other example I can give is that with abortion funding overseas, when Clinton came into office, he did a sort of executive action to allow more funding for abortion programs that money going overseas. When Bush came into office, one of the first things he did was reverse that, right? And so we sometimes see that kind of a thing happening. And that's what presidents are also contemplating. They say, well, if I go the executive route, I might be able to get some things done, but then it'll be more short term. If I go through to the Congress and get something done, it may be sort of a more lasting and have broader depth to it than just how bureaucrats put it into practice.
So because there are only 2 years left in Mr. Obama's term, is that why he's kind of hurrying up to do what – because he made a lot of promises, as you mentioned. And you and a student were talking before we started, and the fact that a lot of people who voted for Mr. Obama are disappointed because of the immigration.
Right, on the issue of immigration. Well, let me say this. So Obama, you know, in his first few years, he had a lot of those new agenda items, right? And this being now the end, toward the end of his term, he's looking at that sort of checklist that he's built up, like most presidents build up their checklist of things they want to get done. And he's really trying to see what he can – what are among those things on the list are high priority that he wants to make sure to get in there before he leaves, so that he at least, you know, gets a good chance of addressing them. With respect to immigration – oh, and I should say, you know, some of the people from last week in the media, they were saying, oh, the president didn't have too many new ideas this time around. Well, it's natural, right, for a two-term president to be trying to wrap things up. And with the little time left, you don't expect to hear too much of like, oh, I have this great brand new idea, right, that would probably take another, you know, term or so, maybe beyond. But so on immigration, when he was running for office for 2008, he said he wanted to do that his first year. But because of all of the other things that came into play with the stimulus bill, with especially the healthcare reform, it became very tough. A lot of people put their necks on the line for healthcare, and by the time that got done, when the 2010 elections were coming up, he didn't have the capital to go after immigration like he wanted to. Then, as he started coming towards the 2012 election, he did a couple of things. He froze deportations at one point through his executive power, which made people who wanted reform on the left, they said they were actually already upset, and they said, well, it was about time from their perspective, because after the first 2 years in office, he had technically deported more people than George W. Bush on his last 2 years in office. So, you know, he's a very liberal progressive president, but on immigration reform, he hasn't gotten around to the kind of reforms that he pledged. Now, right before the 2012 elections, he really did he did a couple of things. The other thing was I mentioned the deferred action policy. When he did those two things among liberal voters, including a good chunk of the Latino vote where immigration was a very important issue, and for Latinos in general, immigration was the second most important right after the economy, that increased enthusiasm for voting for him by 58%, which is tremendous. And it wasn't a surprise that, you know, all these people expected about 12% of the total vote to be a Latino vote for the 2012 election. It turned out to be 16% of the total vote. And in many different – some key states, including New Mexico, Nevada, Florida, it made the difference for him to win those states. And after the election, both Democrats and Republicans were sort of left with this notion of, you know, the Latino votes – you know, there's this you know, old sort of standing stereotype that's among some mainstream media from the 80s, 90s into the early 2000s, that the Latinos, you know, are not that active and all this. It's not true. The Latinos are very active voters. They respond very quickly, and they have a lot of – they give a lot of benefit of the doubt to those politicians who reach out to them. George W. Bush reached out to Latinos in 2004. He got nearly 40% of the vote. Obama reached out this time, and he got almost 75%, about three-fourths of the vote. And it was all banking on the idea that things are going to get done now. And unfortunately, we haven't seen that action. And with the midterms, the new midterms of 2014 coming up, legislators don't want to do it. So when the speech happened last week, some circles of people were very surprised that he didn't have anything more than sort of saying he was going to leave to the House to try to lead on immigration, and he wasn't going to do any of these executive actions. He announced some other executive actions that I think surprised some people both on the left and the right. And we're just going to have to see what, if anything, he does do towards the end of his presidency. Because for those that really thought that mattered, and voted for him in 2008, maybe also in 2014 or 2012, this could be one of the things that defines his legacy, for better or ill, depending on what he does.
Dr. Villalobos, thank you very much for being with us here today. And it's obvious that we could be here talking for a longer time. And we're gonna have you back because I know that you're currently working on an article that's going to be published. And we can talk about some of your other research that you're doing as this term progresses. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
Focus on Campus is taped and produced at the KTAP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Dennis Swoon. You've been tuned to Focus on Campus. I'm Louis Sines.